Maybe later, she said. There was silence again. Then she hauled herself upright in her chair and fought to breathe. Maybe later I'll rest, she said. But first I work. First we all work. We've got to think. We've got to think about the army. What's the racket?
I don't know, Reacher said again.
Well, think for God's sake, she snapped. What racket is he protecting?
Give us what you got, Reacher, Blake said. You didn't go this far without something on your mind.
Reacher shrugged.
Well, I had half an idea, he said.
Give us what you got, Blake said again.
Okay, what was Amy Callan's job?
Blake looked blank and glanced at Poulton.
Ordnance clerk, Poulton said.
Lorraine Stanley's? Reacher asked.
Quartermaster sergeant.
Reacher paused.
Allison's? He asked.
Infantry, close support, Lamar said neutrally.
No, before that.
Transport battalion, she said.
Reacher nodded.
Rita Semeca's job?
Harper nodded.
Weapons proving. Now I see why you made her tell me.
Why?
Blake asked.
Because what's the potential link, Reacher asked, between an ordnance clerk, a quartermaster sergeant, a transport driver, a weapons prover?
You tell me!
What did I take from those guys at the restaurant?
Blake shrugged.
I don't know. That's James Kozo's business in New York. I know you stole their money.
They had handguns, Reacher said. M9 Berettas with the serial numbers filed off. What does that mean?
They were illegally obtained.
Reacher nodded.
From the army. M9 Berettas are military issue.
Blake looked blank.
So what?
So, if this is some army guy protecting a racket, the racket most likely involves theft, and if the stakes are high enough for killing people, the theft most likely involves weapons because that's where the money is. And these women were all in a position where they could have witnessed weapons theft. They were right there in the chain, transporting and testing and warehousing weapons all day long. There was silence. Then Blake shook his head.
You're crazy, he said. It's too coincidental. The overlap is ridiculous. What are the chances all these witnesses would also be harassment victims?
It's only an idea, Reacher said. But the chances are actually pretty good, the way I see it. The only real harassment victim was Julia's sister. Caroline Cook doesn't count because that was a technicality.
What about Callan and Stanley? Poulton asked. You don't call that harassment?
Reacher shook his head. But Lamar beat him to the punch. She was leaning forward, fingers drumming on the table, life back in her eyes, completely on the ball.
Now think about it, people, she said. Think about it laterally. They weren't harassment victims and witnesses. They were harassment victims because they were witnesses. If you're some army racketeer and you've got a woman in your unit who's not turning a blind eye to what you need her to be turning a blind eye to, what do you do about it? You get rid of her is what? And what's the quickest way to do that? You make her uncomfortable sexually.
There was silence. Then Blake shook his head again.
No, Julia, he said. Reacher's seeing ghosts is all. It's still way too coincidental. Because what are the chances he just happened to be in a restaurant alley one night and stumble across the back end of the same racket that's killing our women? 1,000,000 to 1, minimum.
1,000,000,000 to 1, Poulton said.
Lamar stared at them.
Think, for God's sake, she said. Surely he's not saying he saw the same racket that's killing our women. Probably he saw a completely different racket. Because there must be hundreds of rackets in the army, right, Reacher?
Reacher nodded.
Right, he said. The restaurant thing set me thinking along those lines is all, in general terms. There was silence again. Blake colored red.
There are hundreds of rackets, he said. So how does that help us? Hundreds of rackets, hundreds of army people involved. How are we going to find the right one? Needle in a damn haystack. It'll take 3 years. We got 3 weeks.
And what about the paint? Poulton asked.
If he's eliminating witnesses, he'd walk up and shoot them in the head, silence 22. He wouldn't mess with all this other stuff. All this ritual is classic serial homicide.
Reacher looked at him.
Exactly, he said. Your perception of the motive is defined by the manner of the killings. Think about it. If they had all got a silenced 22 in the head, what would you have thought? Poulton said nothing, but there was doubt in his eyes. Blake sat forward and put his hands on the table.
We'd have called them executions, he said. Wouldn't have altered our assessment of the motive.
No, be honest with me, Reacher said. I think you'd have been a little more open-minded. You'd have cast your net a little wider. Sure, you'd have considered the harassment angle, but you'd have considered other things too, more ordinary things, bullets to the head. I think you'd have considered more routine reasons. Blake sat there, hesitant and silent, which was the same thing as a confession. Bullets to the head are kind of normal, right? Reacher said. In your line of work? So you'd have looked at normal reasons, too, like eliminating witnesses to a crime. Bullets to the head, I think right now you'd be all over the army scams looking for some efficient enforcer. But the guy deflected you by dressing it up with all this bizarre bullshit. He hid his true motive. He smokescreened it. He camouflaged it. He pushed you into this weird psychological arena. He manipulated you. Because he's very smart. Blake was still silent. Not that you needed much manipulation, Reacher said.
This is just speculation, Blake said.
Reacher nodded. Of course it is. I told you it's only half an idea. But that's what you do down here, right? You sit here all day long wearing the seat out of your pants speculating about half ideas? Silence in the room.
It's bullshit, Blake said.
Reacher nodded again. Yes, maybe it is. But maybe it isn't. Maybe it's some army guy making big bucks out of some scam these women knew about. And he's hiding behind this harassment issue by dressing it up like a psychodrama. He knew you'd jump right on it. He knew he could make you look in the wrong place. Because he's very smart. Silence. Your call, Reacher said. There was silence.
Julia?
Blake said. The silence continued. Then Lamar nodded slowly.
It's a viable scenario. Maybe more than viable. It's possible he could be exactly right. Possible enough. But I think we should check it out. Maximum effort immediately.
The silence came back.
I think we shouldn't waste any more time, Lamar whispered.
But he's wrong, Poulton said.
He was riffing through paper, and his voice was loud and joyful.
Caroline Cook makes him wrong, he said. She was in war plans at NATO, high-level office work. She was never anywhere near weapons or warehouses or quartermasters.
Reacher said nothing. Then the silence was broken by the door. It opened up and Stavely hurried into the room, big and busy and intrusive. He was dressed in a white lab coat, and his wrists were smeared green where the paint had lapped up above his gloves. Lamar stared at the marks and went whiter than his coat. She stared for a long moment, and then closed her eyes and swayed like she was about to faint. She gripped the tabletop in front of her, thumbs underneath, pale fingers above, spread outward, with the thin tendons standing out like quivering wires.
I want to go home now, she said quietly.
She reached down and gathered up her bag, threaded the strap onto her shoulder and pushed back her chair and stood up. Walked slowly and unsteadily to the door, her eyes fixed on the remnants of her sister's last moments of life daubed across Stavely's stained wrists. Her head turned as she walked to keep them in view. Then she wrenched her gaze away and opened the door, passed through it and let it close silently behind her.
What?
Blake said.
I know how he kills them,
Stavely said.
Except there's a problem. What problem?
Blake asked.
It's impossible.
Chapter 20
I cut a few corners, Stavely said. You need to understand that, okay? You guys are in a big hurry, and we think we're dealing with a consistent MO, so all I did was look at the questions that the first three left behind. I mean, we all know what it isn't, right?
It isn't everything, far as we know, Blake said.
Right,
No blunt trauma, no gunshots, no stab wounds, no poison, no strangulation. So what is it?
Stavely moved a complete circle around the table and sat down at an empty chair on his own, 3 seats from Poulton and 2 from Reacher.
Did she drown? Poulton asked.
Stavely shook his head. No, just like the first 3 didn't. I took a look at her lungs and they were completely clear.
So what is it?
Blake asked again.
Like I told you, Stavely said, you stop the heart or you deny oxygen to the brain. So first, I looked at her heart, and her heart was perfect, completely undamaged, same as the other 3. And these were fit women, great hearts. It's easier to spot the damage on a good heart. An older person might have a bad heart with pre-existing damage, you know, furring or scarring from previous cardiac trouble, and that can hide new damage, but these were perfect hearts, like athletes. Any trauma, it would have stuck out a mile, but there wasn't any. So, he didn't stop their hearts.
So? Blake asked.
So he denied them oxygen, Stavely said. It's the only remaining possibility. How?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? Theoretically, he could have sealed off the bathroom and pumped the oxygen out and replaced it with some inert gas.
Blake shook his head. That's absurd.
Of course it is, Stavely said.
He'd have needed equipment, pumps, tanks of gas. And we'd have found residue in the tissues, certainly in the lungs. There aren't any gases we wouldn't have detected. So?
So he choked off their airways. It's the only possibility.
You said there were no signs of strangulation.
Stavely nodded.
There aren't. That's what got me interested. Strangulation normally leaves massive trauma to the neck. All kinds of bruising, internal bleeding, it sticks out a mile. Same for garroting. But there's something called gentle strangulation.
Gentle? Harper said. Awful phrase.
What is it? Poulton asked.
A guy with a big arm, Stavely said. Or a padded coat sleeve. Gentle, consistent pressure, that will do it.
So is that it? Blake asked.
Stavely shook his head.
No, it isn't. No external marks, but to get far enough to kill them, you leave internal damage. The hyoid bone would be broken, for instance. Certainly cracked, at least. Other ligament damage, too. It's a very fragile area. The voice box is there.
And you're going to tell me there was no damage, I guess, Blake said.
Nothing gross, Stavely said.
Did she have a cold when you met with her?
He looked at Harper, but Reacher answered.
No, he said.
Sore throat?
No.
Husky voice?
She seemed pretty healthy to me.
Stavely nodded, looked pleased. There was some very, very slight swelling inside the throat. It's what you'd get recovering from a head cold. Mucus strip might do it, or a very mild strep virus. 99 times in 100, I'd ignore it completely. But the other 3 had it, too. That's a little coincidental for me.
So what does it mean? Blake asked.
It means he pushed something down their throats, Stavely said.
Silence in the room. Down their throats, Blake repeated.
Stavely nodded.
That was my guess. Something soft, something which would slip down and then expand a little. Maybe a sponge. Were there sponges in the bathroom?
I didn't see one in Spokane, Reacher said.
Poulton was back in the piles of paper.
Nothing on the inventories.
Maybe he removed them, Harper said. He took their clothes.
Bathrooms without sponges, Blake said slowly. Like the dog that didn't bark.
No, Reacher said. There wasn't a sponge before, is what I meant.
You sure? Blake asked.
Reacher nodded.
Totally.
Maybe he brings one with him, Harper said. The type he prefers.
Blake looked away, back to Stavely. So that's how he's doing it? Sponges down their throats?
Stavely stared at his big red hands resting on the tabletop.
It has to be, he said. Sponges or something similar. Like Sherlock Holmes, right? First you eliminate the impossible, and whatever you're left with, however improbable, has got to be the answer. So the guy is choking them to death by pushing something soft down their throats, something soft enough not to cause blunt trauma internally, but something dense enough to block the air.
Blake nodded slowly.
Okay. So now we know.
Stavely shook his head.
Well, no, we don't.
Because it's impossible. Why?
Stavely just shrugged miserably. Come here, Harper, Reacher said. She looked at him, surprised. Then she smiled briefly and stood up and scraped her chair back and walked toward him.
Show don't tell, right?
She said.
Lie on the table, okay?
He asked. She smiled again and sat on the edge of the table and swiveled into position. Reacher pulled Poulton's pile of paper over and pushed it under her head.
Comfortable? He asked.
She nodded and fanned her hair and lay back like she was at the dentist, pulled her jacket closed over her shirt.
Okay, Reacher said. She's Allison Lamar in the tub.
He pulled the top sheet of paper out from under her head and glanced at it. It was the inventory from Caroline Cook's bathroom. He crumpled it into a ball.
This is a sponge, he said. Then he glanced at Blake. Not that there was one in the room.
He brought it with him, Blake said.
Waste of time if he did, Reacher said. Because watch.
He put the crumpled paper to Harper's lips. She clamped them tight.
How do I get her to open her mouth? He asked. In the full and certain knowledge that what I'm doing is going to kill her.
He leaned close and used his left hand under her chin, his fingers and thumb up on her cheeks.
I could squeeze, I guess. Or I could clamp her nose until she had to breathe, but what would she do?
This,
Harper said, and threw a playful roundhouse right which caught Reacher high on the temple.
Exactly, he said. 2 seconds from now we're fighting, and there's a gallon of paint on the floor, another gallon all over me. To get anywhere with this, I'd have to get right in the tub with her, behind her, or on top of her.
He's right, Stavely said. It's just impossible. They'd be fighting for their lives. No way to force something into somebody's mouth against their will, without leaving bruises on their cheeks, their jaws, all over them. Flesh would tear against their teeth. Their lips would be bruised and cut. Maybe the teeth themselves would loosen. And they'd be biting and scratching and kicking. Traces under their nails, bruised knuckles, defensive injuries. It would be a fight to the death, right? And there's no evidence of fighting, none at all.
Maybe he drugged them, Blake said.
Made them passive, you know, like that date rape thing.
Stavely shook his head. Nobody was drugged, he said. Toxicology is absolutely clear, all 4 cases. The room went silent again, and Reacher pulled Harper upright by the hands. She slid off the table and dusted herself down, walked back to her seat.
So you've got no conclusions? Blake asked.
Stavely shrugged.
Like I said, I've got a great conclusion. But it's an impossible conclusion.
Silence. I told you, this is a very smart guy, Reacher said. Too smart for you. Way too smart. 4 homicides, and you still don't know how he's doing it.
So what's the answer, smart guy? Blake said. You gonna tell us something 4 of the nation's best pathologists can't tell us?
Reacher said nothing.
What's the answer?
Blake asked again.
I don't know, Reacher said.
Great, you don't know.
But I'll find out.
Yeah? Like how?
Easy. I'll go find the guy, and I'll ask him.
41 miles away, slightly east of north, the colonel was 2 miles from his office after a 10-mile journey. He had taken the shuttle bus from the Pentagon's parking lot and gotten off near the Capitol. Then he had hailed a cab and headed back over the river to the National Airport's main terminal. His uniform was in a leather one-suiter slung on his shoulder, and he was cruising the ticket counters at the busiest time of day, completely anonymous in a teeming crush of people.
I want Portland, Oregon, he said. Open round trip, coach.
A clerk entered the code for Portland, and his computer told him he had plenty of availability on the next nonstop.
Leaves in 2 hours, he said.
Okay, the colonel said.
You think you'll find the guy?
Blake repeated.
Reacher nodded. I'll have to, won't I? It's the only way.
There was silence in the conference room for a moment, then Stavely stood up.
Well, good luck to you, sir, he said.
He walked out of the room and closed the door softly behind him.
You won't find the guy, Poulton said. Because you're wrong about Caroline Cook. She never served, and
ordnance warehousing or weapons testing. She proves your theory is shit.
Reacher smiled.
Do I know all about FBI procedures?
No, you don't.
So don't talk to me about the Army.
Cook was an officer candidate. Fast-track type. Had to be to finish up in war plans. People like that, they send them all over the place first, getting an overview. That summary you've got in your file is incomplete.
It is?
Reacher nodded.
Has to be. If they listed everywhere she was posted, you'd have 10 pages before she made first lieutenant. You check back with defense, get the details, you'll find she was someplace they could tie her in.
The silence came back. There was a faint rush from the forced air heating and a buzz from a failing fluorescent tube. A high-pitched whistle from the silent television. That was all. Nothing else. Poulton stared at Blake. Harper stared at Reacher. Blake looked down at his fingers, which were tapping on the table with silent, fleshy impacts.
"Can you find him?"
he asked.
"Somebody's got to," Reacher said. "You guys aren't getting anywhere." "You'll need resources."
Reacher nodded.
"A little help would be nice." "So I'm gambling here."
"Better than putting all your chips behind a loser."
"I'm gambling big time, with a lot at stake."
"Like your career?"
7 women, not my career."
7 women and your career."
Blake nodded vaguely. "What are the odds?"
Reacher shrugged.
"With 3 weeks to do it in,
it's a certainty."
"You're an arrogant bastard, you know that?"
"No, I'm realistic is all."
"So what do you need?"
"Remuneration," Reacher said.
"You want to get paid?"
"Sure I do. You're getting paid, right? I do all the work, only fair I get something out of it, too."
Blake nodded. "You find the guy, I'll speak to Deerfield up in New York. Get the Petrosian thing forgotten about."
"Plus a fee."
"How much?"
"Whatever you think is appropriate."
Blake nodded again. "I'll think about it. And Harper goes with you, because right now the Petrosian thing ain't forgotten about."
"Okay. I can live with that if she can."
"She doesn't get a choice," Blake said. "What else?"
"Set me up with Kozo. I'll start in New York. I'll need information from him."
Blake nodded. "I'll call him. You can see him tonight."
Reacher shook his head. "Tomorrow morning. Tonight, I'm going to see Jody."
Chapter 21. The meeting broke up in a sudden burst of energy. Blake took the elevator 1 floor down back to his office to place the call to James Kozo in New York. Poulton had calls of his own to make to the bureau office in Spokane, where the local guys were checking with parcel carriers and car rental operations. Harper went up to the travel desk to organize airline tickets. Reacher was left alone in the seminar room, sitting at the big table, ignoring the television, staring at a fake window like he was looking out at a view. He sat like that for nearly 20 minutes, just waiting. Then Harper came back in. She was carrying a thick sheaf of new paperwork.
"More bureaucracy," she said. "If we pay you, we've got to insure you. Travel desk regulations."
She sat down opposite him and took a pen from her inside pocket.
"Ready for this?"
she said. He nodded.
"Full name?"
she asked.
"Jack Reacher," he said.
"That the whole thing?"
He nodded.
"That's it."
"Not a very long name, is it?"
He shrugged, said nothing. She wrote it down. 2 words, 11 letters, in a space which ran the whole width of the form.
"Date of birth?"
he told her. Saw her calculating his age. Saw surprise in her face.
"Older or younger?" he asked.
"Then what?"
"Than you thought."
She smiled.
"Oh, older. You don't look it."
"Bullshit," he said. "I look about 100. Certainly I feel about 100.
She smiled again.
"You probably clean up pretty good. Social Security number?"
His generation of servicemen, it was the same as his military ID. He rattled through it in the military manner, random monotone sounds representing whole numbers between 0 and 9.
"Full address?"
"No fixed abode," he said.
"You sure?"
"Why wouldn't I be?"
"What about garrison?"
"What about it?"
"Your house," she said. "That would be your address, right?"
He stared at her, I guess so. Sort of. I never really thought about it. She stared back.
You own a house, you've got an address, wouldn't you say?
Okay, put Garrison.
Street name and number?
He dredged it up from his memory and told her.
Zip?
He shrugged. I don't know.
You don't know your own zip code?
He was quiet for a second. She looked at him.
You've got it real bad, haven't you?
She said. Got what?
Whatever. Call it denial, I guess.
He nodded slowly. Yes, I guess I've got it real bad.
So what are you going to do about it?
I don't know. Maybe I'll get used to it.
Maybe you won't.
What would you do?
People should do what they really want, she said. I think that's important.
Is that what you do? She nodded.
My folks wanted me to stay in Aspen. They wanted me to be a teacher or something. I wanted to be in law enforcement. It was a big battle.
It's not my parents doing this to me. They're dead.
I know. It's Jody.
He shook his head. No, it's not Jody. It's me. I'm doing this to myself. She nodded again.
Okay.
The room went quiet. So what should I do? He asked. She shrugged warily.
I'm not the person to ask.
Why not?
I might not give the answer you want.
Which is?
You want me to say you should stay with Jody, settle down, and be happy.
I do?
I think so.
But you can't say that. She shook her head.
No, I can't, she said. I had a boyfriend. It was pretty serious. He was a cop in Aspen. There was always tension, you know, between cops and the Bureau. Rivalry. Silly, really. No reason for it, but it's there. It spread into personal things. He wanted me to quit, begged me. I was torn, but I said no.
Was that the right choice? She nodded.
For me, yes, it was. You have to do what you really want.
Would it be the right choice for me? She shrugged.
I can't say, but probably.
First, I need to figure out what I really want.
You know what you really want, she said. Everybody always does, instinctively. Any doubt you're feeling is just noise trying to bury the truth because you don't want to face it.
He looked away, back to the fake window.
Occupation?
She asked. Silly question, he said.
I'll put consultant.
He nodded. That dignifies it somewhat. Then there were footsteps in the corridor, and the door opened again, and Blake and Poulton hurried inside, more paper in their hands, and the glow of progress in their faces.
We're maybe halfway to starting to get somewhere, Blake said. News in from Spokane. The local UPS driver quit 3 weeks ago, Poulton said. Moved to Missoula, Montana. Works in a warehouse. But they spoke to him by phone, and he thinks maybe he remembers the delivery.
So doesn't the UPS office have paperwork? Harper asked.
Blake shook his head.
They archive it after 11 days. And we're looking at 2 months ago. If the driver can pinpoint the day, we might get it.
Anybody know anything about baseball? Poulton asked.
Reacher shrugged. Couple of guys worked out an overall all-time top 10, and only two players had the letter U in their names.
Why baseball? Harper asked.
Day in question, some Seattle guy hit a grand slam, Blake said. The driver heard it on his radio, remembers it.
Seattle, he would remember it, Reacher said. Rare occurrence.
Babe Ruth, Poulton said. Who's the other one?
Honus Wagner, Reacher said.
Poulton looked blank.
Never heard of him. And Hertz came through, Blake said. They think they remember a real short rental, Spokane Airport, the exact day Allison died. In and out inside about 2 hours.
They got a name?
Harper asked. Blake shook his head.
Their computer's down, they're working on it.
Don't the desk people remember?
Are you kidding? Lucky if those people remember their own names.
So when will we get it?
Tomorrow, I guess. Morning, with a bit of luck. Otherwise, the afternoon.
3 hour time difference, it'll be the afternoon for us.
Probably.
So does Reacher still go?
Blake paused, and Reacher nodded. I still go, he said. The name will be phony, for sure, and the UPS thing will lead nowhere. This guy's way too smart for basic paper trail errors. Everybody waited.
Then Blake nodded.
I guess I agree, he said. So Reacher still goes.
They got a ride in a plain Bureau Chevrolet and were at the airport in D.C. before dark. They lined up for the United shuttle with the lawyers and the lobbyists. Reacher was the only person on the line not wearing a business suit, male or female. The cabin crew seemed to know most of the passengers and greeted them at the airplane door like regulars. Harper walked all the way down the aisle and chose seats right at the back.
No rush to get off, she said. You're not seeing Kozo until tomorrow.
Reacher said nothing.
And Jody won't be home yet, she said. Lawyers work hard, right? Especially the ones fixing to be partner.
He nodded. He'd just gotten around to figuring the same thing.
So we'll sit here, she said. It's quieter.
The engines are right back here, he said.
But the guys in suits aren't.
He smiled and took the window seat and buckled up.
And we can talk back here, she said. I don't like people listening.
We should sleep, he said. We're going to be busy.
I know, but talk first. 5 minutes, okay?
Talk about what?
The scratches on her face, she said. I need to understand what that's about.
He glanced across at her. Why? You figuring to crack this all on your own? She nodded.
I wouldn't turn down the opportunity to make the arrest.
Ambitious? She made a face.
Competitive, I guess?
He smiled again. Lisa Harper against the pointy heads.
Damn right, she said. Plain vanilla agents, they treat us like shit.
The engines wound up to a scream and the plane rolled backward from the gate. Swung its nose around and lumbered toward the runway.
So what about the marks on her face?
Harper asked. I think it proves my point, Reacher said. I think it's the single most valuable piece of evidence we've gotten so far.
Why?
He shrugged. It was so half-hearted, wasn't it? So tentative. I think it proves the guy is hiding behind appearances. It proves he's pretending. Like, there's me looking at the cases, and I'm thinking, where's the violence? Where's the anger? And simultaneously, somewhere, the guy is reviewing his progress, and he's thinking, oh my God, I'm not showing any anger. And so on the next one, he tries to show some. But he's not really feeling any. So it comes across as really nothing much at all. Harper nodded.
Not even enough to make her flinch, according to Stavely.
Bloodless, Reacher said, almost literally. Like a technical exercise, which it was, because this whole thing is a technical exercise. Some cast-iron, down-to-earth motive hiding behind a psycho masquerade.
He made her do it to herself.
I think so.
But why would he?
Worried about fingerprints? About revealing if he's left-handed or right-handed? Demonstrating his control?
It's a lot of control, don't you think? But it explains why it was so half-hearted. She wouldn't really hurt herself.
I guess not, he said sleepily.
Why Allison, though? Why did he wait until number 4?
Ceaseless quest for perfection, I suppose. A guy like this, he's thinking and refining all the time.
Does it make her special in some way? Significant?
Reacher shrugged. That's pointy head stuff. If they thought so, I'm sure they'd have said.
Maybe he knew her better than the others. Worked with her more closely.
Maybe. But don't stray into their territory. Keep your feet on the ground. You're plain vanilla, remember? Harper nodded.
And the plain vanilla motive is money.
Has to be, Reacher said. Always love or money. And it can't be love because love makes you crazy and this guy isn't crazy. The plane turned and stopped hard against its brakes at the head of the runway. Paused for a second and jumped forward and accelerated. Unstuck itself and lifted heavily into the air. The lights of D.C. spun past the window.
Why did he change the interval?
Harper asked over the noise of the climb. Reacher shrugged. Maybe he just wanted to.
Wanted to?
Maybe he just did it for fun. Nothing more disruptive for you guys than a pattern that changes.
Will it change again?
The plane rocked and tilted and leveled, and the engine noise fell away to a cruise. It's over, Reacher said. The women are guarded, and you'll be making the arrest pretty soon.
You're that confident?
Reacher shrugged again.
No point going in expecting to lose. He yawned and jammed his head between the seat back and the plastic bulkhead, closed his eyes. "Wake me when we get there," he said. But the thump and whine of the wheels coming down woke him, 3,000 feet above and 3 miles east of LaGuardia in New York. He looked at his watch and saw he'd slept 50 minutes. His mouth tasted tired.
"You want to get some dinner?"
Harper asked him. He blinked and checked his watch again. He had at least an hour to kill before Jody's earliest possible ETA, probably 2 hours, maybe 3.
"You got somewhere in mind?" he asked back.
"I don't know New York too well," she said. "I'm an Aspen girl."
"I know a good Italian," he said.
"They put me in a hotel in Park in 36th, she said. "I assume you're staying at Jody's."
He nodded. "I assume I am, too."
"So is this restaurant near Park in 36th?
He shook his head. "Cab ride. This is a big town."
She shook her head in turn.
"No cabs. They'll send a car, ours for the duration."
The driver was waiting at the gate. Same guy who had driven them before. His car was parked in the tow lane outside arrivals, with a large card with the Bureau shield printed on it propped behind the windshield. Congestion was bad all the way into Manhattan. It was the second half of rush hour. But the guy drove like he had nothing to fear from the traffic cops, and they were outside Mastro's within 40 minutes of the plane touching down. The street was dark, and the restaurant glowed like a promise. 4 tables were occupied, and Puccini was playing. The owner saw Reacher on the sidewalk and hurried to the door, beaming. Showed them to a table and brought the menus himself.
"This is the place Petrosian was leaning on?"
Harper asked. Reacher nodded toward the owner. "Look at the little guy. Did he deserve that?"
"You should have left it to the cops."
"That's what Jody said.
She's clearly a smart woman."
It was warm inside the huge room, and Harper slipped her jacket off and twisted to hang it over the back of her chair. Her shirt twisted with her, tightening and loosening. First time since he'd met her, she was wearing a bra. She followed his gaze and blushed.
"I wasn't sure who we'd be meeting," she said.
He nodded. "We'll be meeting somebody," he said. "That's for damn sure, sooner or later." The way he said it made her glance up at him.
"Now you really want this guy, right?"
she said. "Yes, now I do."
"For Amy Callan? You liked her, didn't you?"
"She was okay. I liked Alison Lamar better, what I saw of her. But I want this guy for Rita Semeca."
"She likes you too," she said. "I could tell."
He nodded again.
"Did you have a relationship with her?"
He shrugged. "That's a very vague word."
"An affair?"
He shook his head. "I only met her after she was raped. Because she was raped. She wasn't in any kind of a state to be having affairs. Still isn't, by the look of it. I was a little older than she was, maybe 5 or 6 years. We got very friendly, but it was like a paternalistic thing, you know? Which I guess she needed. But she hated it at the same time. I had to work hard to make it feel at least brotherly, as I recall. We went out a few times, but like big brother and little sister, always completely platonic. She was like a wounded soldier, recuperating."
"That's how she saw it?"
"Exactly like that," he said. "Like a guy who has his leg shot off. It can't be denied, but it can be dealt with. She was dealing with it."
"And now this guy is setting her back."
Reacher nodded. "That's the problem. Hiding behind this harassment thing, he's pounding on an open wound. If he was upfront about it, it would be okay. Rita could accept that as a separate problem, I think. Like a one-legged guy could deal with getting the flu. But it's coming across like a taunt about her past."
"And that makes you mad?"
"I feel responsible for Rita. He's messing with her, so he's messing with me."
"And people shouldn't mess with you."
"No, they shouldn't."
"Or?"
"Or they're deep in the shit." She nodded slowly.
"You've convinced me," she said.
He said nothing.
"You convinced Petrosian too, I guess,"
she said. "I never went near Petrosian," he said. "Never laid eyes on him."
"But you are kind of arrogant, you know," she said. "Prosecutor, judge, jury, executioner, all in one. What about the rules?"
He smiled. Those are the rules, he said. People mess with me, they find that out pretty damn quick. Harper shook her head.
We arrest this guy, remember? We find him and we arrest him. We're going to do this properly according to my rules, okay?
He nodded. I already agreed to that. Then the waiter came over and stood near, pen poised. They ordered 2 courses each and sat in silence until the food came. Then they ate in silence. There wasn't much of it, but it was as good as always. Maybe even better. And it was on the house. After coffee, the FBI driver took Harper to her hotel uptown and Reacher walked down to Jody's place, alone and enjoying it. He let himself into her lobby and rode up in the elevator. Let himself into her apartment. The air was still and silent. The rooms were dark. Nobody home. He switched on lamps and closed blinds. Sat down on the living room sofa to wait. Chapter 22.
This time there will be guards. You know that for sure. So this time will be difficult. You smile to yourself and correct your phraseology. Actually, this time will be very difficult. Very, very difficult. But not impossible. Not for you. It will be a challenge is all. Putting guards into the equation will elevate the whole thing up a little nearer to interesting. A little nearer the point where your talent can really flex and stretch like it needs to. It will be a challenge to relish. A challenge to beat. But you don't beat anything without thinking. You don't beat anything without careful observation and planning. The guards are a new factor, so they need analysis. But that's your strength, isn't it? Accurate, dispassionate analysis? Nobody does it better than you. You've proved that over and over again, haven't you? 4 whole times. So, what do the guards mean to you? Initial question, who are the guards? Out here in the sticks, 1 million miles from nowhere, first impression is you're dealing with dumbass local cops. No immediate problem. No immediate threat. But the downside is, out here in the sticks, 1 million miles from nowhere, there aren't enough dumbass local cops to go around. Some tiny Oregon township outside of the Portland city limits won't have enough cops to keep up a 24-hour watch. So they'll be looking for help. And you know that help will come from the FBI. You know that for sure. The way you predict it, the locals will take the day, and the Bureau will take the night. Given the choice, obviously you aren't going to tangle with the Bureau. So you're going to avoid the night. You're going to take the day, when all that stands between you and her is some local fat boy in a Crown Vic full of cheeseburger wrappers and cold coffee. And you're going to take the day because the day is a more elegant solution. Broad daylight. You love the phrase. They use it all the time, don't they? The crime was committed in broad daylight, you whisper to yourself. Getting past the locals in broad daylight won't be too hard. But even so, it's not something you're going to undertake lightly. You're not going to rush in. You're going to watch carefully from a distance till you see how it goes. You're going to invest some time in careful, patient observation. Fortunately, you've got a little time. And it won't be hard to do. The place is mountainous. Mountainous places have 2 characteristics, 2 advantages. First of all, they're already full of idiots hanging out in sweaters with field glasses around their necks. And second of all, mountainous terrain makes it easy to see point A from point B. You just get yourself concealed high up on some peak or knoll or whatever the hell they call them. Then you settle in, and you gaze downward, and you watch, and you wait.
Reacher waited a long time in the stillness of Jody's living room. His posture on the sofa changed from sitting to sprawling. After an hour, he swiveled around and lay down, closed his eyes, opened them again and struggled to stay awake, closed them again, kept them closed. Figured he'd catch 10 minutes. Figured he'd hear the elevator, or the door. But when it came to it, he heard neither.
He woke up and found her bending over him, kissing his cheek.
"Hey, Reacher," she said softly.
He pulled her to him and held her in a tight, silent embrace. She hugged back, one-handed because she was still carrying her briefcase, but hard.
"How was your day?" he asked.
"Later," she whispered.
She dropped the briefcase and he pulled her down on top of him. She struggled out of her coat and let it fall. The silk lining whispered and sighed. She was in a wool dress with a zipper all the way down the back to the base of her spine. He unzipped it slowly and felt the warmth of her body underneath. She pushed up with her elbows, sharp points in his stomach. Her hands scrabbled at his shirt. He pushed the dress off her shoulders. She pulled his shirt out of his waistband, tore at his belt. She stood up, and her dress fell to the floor. She held out her hand, and he took it, and she led him to the bedroom. They stumbled out of their clothes as they walked, made it to the bed. It was white and cool. Neon glow from the city outside lit it in random patterns. She pushed him down with her hands on his shoulders. She was strong like a gymnast, urgent and energetic and lithe on top of him. He was lost. They finished, filmed in sweat, in a tangle of sheets. She was pressed against him. He could feel her heart hammering on his chest. Her hair was in his mouth. He was breathing hard. She was smiling. Her face was tucked into his shoulder, and he could feel the smile against his skin, the shape of her mouth, the cool of her teeth, the impatient curve in the muscles of her cheek. She was beautiful in a way he couldn't describe. She was tall and lean and graceful, and blonde and faintly tanned, and she had spectacular hair and eyes. But she was more than that. She was shot through with energy and will and passion, crackling with restless intelligence like electricity. He traced his hand down the smooth curve of her back. She stretched her foot all the way down his leg and tried to lace her toes into his. The secret smile was still there against his neck.
"Now you can ask me about my day," she said.
Her words were muffled by his shoulder. "How was your day?" he asked. She put her hand flat on his chest and pushed herself up onto her elbow, made a shape with her mouth and blew her hair off her face. Then the smile came back.
"It was great," she said.
He smiled in turn. "Great how?" he asked.
"Secretary gossip," she said. "Mine talked to one from upstairs over lunch."
"And?"
"There's a partners' meeting in a few days."
"And?"
"The upstairs secretary had just typed the agenda. They're going to make a partnership offer."
He smiled.
"Who to?"
She smiled back.
"To one of the associates."
"Which one?"
"Guess."
He pretended to think about it. "They go for somebody special, right? The best they got, the smartest, hardest working, most charming and all that."
"That's what they usually do."
He nodded. "Congratulations, babe. You deserve it. You really do." She smiled happily and threaded her arms around his neck, pressed herself down in a full-body hug, head to toe.
"Partner," she said, "what I always wanted."
"You deserve it," he said again. "You really do."
"Partner at 30, she said. "Can you believe it?"
He stared up at the ceiling and smiled. "Yes, I can believe it. If you'd gone into politics, you'd be president by now."
"I can't believe it," she said. "I never can when I get what I want."
Then she was quiet for a second.
"But it hasn't happened yet," she said. "Maybe I should wait until it has."
"It'll happen," he said.
"It's only an agenda. Maybe they'll all vote no."
"They won't," he said.
"There'll be a party," she said. "Will you come?"
"If you want me to, if I won't ruin your image."
"You could buy a suit, wear your medals, you'd blow them away."
He was quiet for a spell, thinking about buying a suit. If he did, it would be the first suit he'd ever worn.
"Have you got what you want?" she asked.
He wrapped his arms around her. "Right now?"
"Overall."
I want to sell the house, he said. She lay still for a moment.
Okay, she said. Not that you need my permission.
It burdens me down, he said. I can't handle it.
You don't need to explain to me.
I could live the rest of my life on the money I get for it.
You'd have to pay taxes.
He nodded. Whatever. What's left would buy me plenty of motel rooms.
You should think carefully. It's the only asset you've got.
Not to me. Money for motels is an asset. The house is a burden. She was silent. I'm going to sell my car, too, he said.
Thought you liked it, she said.
He nodded. It's okay, for a car.
Just don't like owning things. Owning a car isn't exactly the end of the world.
It is to me. Too much hassle. It needs insurance, all that kind of stuff.
You don't have insurance?
I thought about it, he said. They need all kinds of paperwork first.
She paused. How will you get around?
Same as I always did. Hitch rides, take the bus. She paused again.
Okay. Sell the car if you want to, she said. But maybe keep the house. It's useful.
He shook his head next to hers. Drives me crazy. He felt her smile.
You're the only person I know who wants to be homeless, she said. Most people try real hard to avoid it.
There's nothing I want more, he said. Like you want to make partner, I want to be free.
Free of me too? She asked quietly.
Free of the house, he said. It's a burden, like an anchor. You're not. She unwrapped her arms from his neck and propped herself on an elbow.
I don't believe you, she said. The house anchors you, and you don't like it, but I anchor you too, don't I?
The house makes me feel bad, he said. You make me feel good. I only know how I feel.
So you'd sell the house, but you'd stick around New York?
He was quiet for a beat. I'd maybe move around a little, he said. You travel. You're busy a lot of the time. We could make it work.
We'd drift apart.
I don't think so.
You'd stay away longer and longer.
He shook his head. It'll be the same as it's been all year, except I won't have the house to worry about.
You've made up your mind, right?
He nodded. It's driving me crazy. I don't even know the zip code, presumably because I don't want to know deep down.
You don't need my permission, she said again. Then she was silent.
You upset? He asked uselessly.
Worried, she said.
It won't change anything, he said.
So why do it?
Because I have to. She didn't reply. They fell asleep like that in each other's arms, with a strand of melancholy laced through the afterglow. Morning came, and there was no time for more talk. Jody showered and left with no breakfast and without asking him what he was doing or when he'd be back. He showered and dressed and locked up the apartment and rode down the street and found Lisa Harper waiting for him. She was dressed in her third suit, and she was leaning on the fender of the bureau car. The day was bright with cold sun, and the light was on her hair. The car was stopped at the curb with angry traffic swarming around it. The bureau driver was motionless behind the wheel, staring straight ahead. The air was full of noise.
You okay?
She asked. He shrugged. I guess. So let's go. The driver fought traffic 20 blocks uptown and went underground into the same crowded garage Lamar had brought him to. They used the same elevator in the corner, rode up to the 21st floor, stepped out into the same quiet gray corridor. The driver preceded them like a host and pointed to his left. Third door, he said. James Kozo was behind his desk and looked as though he might have been there for an hour. He was in shirt sleeves. His jacket was on a hanger on a bentwood hat stand. He was watching television, political cable, an earnest reporter in front of the Capitol, rapid cutaways to the Hoover Building, the budget hearings. The return of the vigilante, he said. He nodded to Harper and closed a file.
muted the television sound, and pushed back from his desk and rubbed his hands over his narrow face like he was washing without water.
"So, what do you want?"
he asked. "Addresses," Reacher said, "for Petrosian's boys.
The two you put in the hospital? They won't be pleased to see you."
"They'll be pleased to see me leave."
"You gonna hurt them again?"
"Probably." Kozo nodded.
"Suits me, pal."
He pulled a file from a stack and rooted through it, copied an address onto a slip of paper.
"They live together," he said. "They're brothers."
Then he thought again and tore the paper into shreds, reversed the open file on the desk and took a new sheet of paper, tossed a pencil on top of it.
"You copy it," he said. "Don't want my handwriting anywhere near this, literally or metaphorically."
The address was near 5th, on 66th Street.
"Nice neighborhood," Reacher said. "Expensive."
Kozo nodded again.
"Lucrative operation."
Then he smiled.
"Well, it was," he said, "until you got busy down in Chinatown."
Reacher said nothing.
"Take a taxi," Kozo said to Harper. "And you stay out of the way. No overt bureau involvement here, okay?"
She nodded reluctantly.
"Have fun," Kozo said.
They walked over to Madison with Harper craning like a tourist, caught a cab uptown and got out on the corner of 60th Street.
"We'll walk the rest of the way," Reacher said.
"We?"
Harper said.
"Good. I want to stay involved."
"You have to stay involved," Reacher said, "because I won't get in without you."
The address led them 6 blocks north to a plain, medium-high apartment building faced with gray brick. Metal window frames, no balconies. Air conditioners built through the walls under the windows. No awning over the sidewalk, no doorman, but it was clean and well-kept.
"Expensive place?"
Harper asked. Reacher shrugged.
"I don't know. Not the most expensive, I guess, but they won't be giving them away."
The street door was open, the lobby was narrow, with hard stucco walls carefully streaked with paint, so they looked a little like marble. There was a single elevator at the back of the lobby with a narrow brown door. The apartment they wanted was on the 8th floor. Reacher touched the elevator button and the door rolled back. The car was lined with bronze mirror on all 4 sides. Harper stepped in and Reacher crowded after her, pressed 8. An infinite number of reflections rode up with them.
"You knock on their door," Reacher said. "Get them to open up. They won't if they see me in the spy hole."
She nodded and the elevator stopped on 8. The door rolled back. They stepped out on a dull landing the same shape as the lobby. The apartment they were looking for was in the back of the building on the right. Reacher stood flat against the wall and Harper stood in front of the door. She bent forward and then back to flip her hair off her face, took a breath, and raised her hand and knocked on the door. Nothing happened for a moment. Then Harper stiffened like she was under scrutiny. There was a rattle of chain from the inside and the door opened a crack.
"Building management?"
Harper said.
"I need to check the air conditioners."
Wrong season, Reacher thought. But Harper was more than 6 feet tall and had blonde hair more than a yard long, and her hands in her pockets so the front of her shirt was pulled tight. The door pushed shut for a second and the chain rattled again, and the door swung back. Harper stepped inside like she was accepting a gracious invitation. Reacher peeled off the wall and followed her in before the door closed again. It was a small, dark apartment with a view of the light well. Everything was brown, rugs, furniture, drapes. There was a small foyer opening to a small living room. The living room held a sofa and 2 armchairs, and Harper. And both of the guys Reacher had last seen leaving the alley behind Mastro's.
"Hey, guys," he said. "We're brothers," the first guy said, irrelevantly.
They both had broad strips of hospital gauze taped to their foreheads, stark white, a little longer and broader than the labels Reacher had stuck there. One of them had bandages on his hands. They were dressed identically in sweaters and golf pants. Without their bulky overcoats, they looked smaller. One guy was wearing boat shoes. The other was wearing moccasin slippers that looked like he'd made them himself from a mail-order kit. Reacher stared at them and felt his aggression drain away.
"Shit," he said.
They stared back at him.
"Sit down," he said.
They sat side by side on the sofa. They watched him with fearful eyes hooded under the ludicrous gauze.
"Are these the right guys?"
Harper asked. Reacher nodded. "Things change, I guess."